Coming up next on Louisiana Eats, we learn what the buzz about bees is all about. We begin at the Audubon Zoo, suiting up with curator Dominique Fleetus to meet the colonies of honeybees she helps maintain there.
They're amazing, especially when you get a chance to look up close at them, sticking their little tongues in, trying to get a little bit of honey that has spilled, and I get taken away just looking at them.
Then we learn about a therapeutic New Zealand honey that Gwyneth Paltrow thinks is the bee's knees, Manuka honey.
It astounds me even today that we sell a one-pound jar of Manuka honey from $20 all the way up to $120. There's a short demand of it, and that's why the price keeps going up.
Our guests have an avocation for pollination on this week's Louisiana Eats. That's coming up next. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. President Trump says the U.S. does not support Turkey's attacks in northeast Syria and has told Ankara the operation is a bad idea. But as NPR's Peter Kenyon reports, Turkey's president says the campaign has now begun and will prevent what he calls a terror corridor from forming.
President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says the operation is intended to eliminate the threat from Syrian Kurdish fighters known as the YPG. They partnered with the U.S. to reclaim territory from Islamic State forces, but Turkey views the YPG as terrorists. Kurdish officials say some of the attacks are hitting civilian areas and are warning of a humanitarian catastrophe.
The EU is urging Turkey to end its operation and rejects Ankara's plans to create a safe zone. The UN is calling on the U.S. military to stop bombing drug-making facilities in Afghanistan. As NPR's Dia Hadid reports from Islamabad, the call follows a UN investigation into a series of strikes last May that killed dozens of civilians.
The UN said they were still trying to confirm whether another 37 people, mostly women and children, were among the victims. They said the May 5 airstrikes hit some meth labs, but also people's homes. And they said combating Afghanistan's enormous drug trade had to be done by other means. The US and Afghan government have stepped up their airstrikes to try push back ISIS and Taliban insurgents. But they've come under increased scrutiny lately because of the civilian casualties. The UN estimates more civilians have been killed this year by government forces and their Western allies than by insurgents. They include 20 farmers who were killed by US airstrike in September while they were harvesting pine nuts. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Islamabad.
Attorneys for 12 young Alaskans who are suing over state climate change policy are expected to argue their case before the Alaska Supreme Court today. In the meantime, a new study concludes federal buyouts of flood-prone homes are concentrated in the country's wealthier counties. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports the finding raises concerns about who's able to move out of harm's way.
Climate change is driving more flooding as sea levels rise and extreme rain gets more common in many parts of the country. One way the federal government can help move people out of harm's way is to buy their homes and allow them to use the money to move to higher ground. But research published today finds that richer, more densely populated communities are completing more buyouts than poorer, more rural places with similar flood risk. The study was published in the journal Science Advances. The findings mirror those of an NPR investigation earlier this year that found the majority of FEMA buyouts have gone to communities with more than 85% white residents. The authors of the new study also found that coastal communities are buying out more homes than in the past. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
This is NPR. A jailed independence activist in Hong Kong went to court today to appeal his prison sentence. NPR's Emily Fang reports hundreds of supporters turned out in front of the courthouse while Edward Leung was at his hearing inside.
Leung's mass supporters shouted his signature slogan, "Liberate Hong Kong, Revolution of Our Times," a slogan now widely used in the current anti-government protests that are now in their fourth month. Supporters also held up five fingers, representing the five demands which include universal suffrage they have for the city's Beijing-backed government. Leung is a hero to many protesters. He rose to prominence with his more radical anti-China views. Leung was sentenced last year to 6 years prison time for, quote, rioting during smaller 2016 protests. He was banned from running for office because Beijing argued his pro-independence stance went against Hong Kong's legal foundation. Emily Fang, NPR News, Hong Kong.
Northern California's power company PG&E is shutting off electricity to hundreds of thousands of customers at least through tomorrow, a preventative step to keep its equipment from sparking wildfires as the hot Santa Ana winds blow in. The utility says it's also considering turning off power for tens of thousands of customers near Southern California. The Nobel Committee announced this year's winners of the Chemistry Prize. It's going to three researchers whose discoveries led to the lithium-ion battery. They're seemingly everywhere, cars and cell phones. They've reduced the world's reliance on fossil fuels. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the financial services firm of Raymond James, offering personalized wealth management advice and banking and capital markets expertise, along with a legacy of putting clients' financial well-being first. Learn more at RaymondJames.com.
Born on the Bayou, with music from John Fred, Van Broussard, Don Rich, Fats Domino, Rod Bernard, T.K. Hulam. Lee Kleinpeter with you for an hour of solid Louisiana gold, Saturday afternoon at 3 on KRVS for Born on the Bayou. Join me for an enduring and endearing hour of swamp pop and more this Saturday on KRVS, Born on the Bayou.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Zatarain's, maker of New Orleans pantry staples like Creole mustard, fish fry, and jambalaya mix since 1889. Recipes and more at Zatarain's.com. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. The humble little honeybee is actually one of the most important players in our ecosystem. On this week's show, we're circling the globe in pursuit of a honey of a tale. We begin right here in our own backyard at the Audubon Zoo. While you may go to the zoo to visit more exotic creatures, the honeybees are there in their own secluded hives. We'll visit them and then take off down under to learn all about the magical properties of Manuka honey, a honey unique to New Zealand. We'll have an apian chat with Chicago's superstar chef, Rick Bayless, whose passion for bees is simply boundless. And finally, we'll return home to discover the story of the hidden hives of Mid-City. We're all abuzz on this week's Louisiana Eats. At New Orleans' Audubon Zoo, you can expect to find the kinds of animals that have enchanted zoo-goers for generations. Tigers, elephants, giraffes. But the zoo is also home to tens of thousands of tiny creatures that, although they may not draw the same kind of crowd, play a vital role in our food system. I'm talking, of course, about those prolific pollinators, bees. Curators and animal keepers have managed bee colonies at the Audubon Zoo since 2016, maintaining two hives tucked away behind the alligator lagoon. Since then, the zoo has set up a more public space, a garden that provides host plants and foraging opportunities for our native bees and butterflies.
Our pollinator garden is located in between our orangutan exhibit and our elephant exhibit. So we're up against some competition, but it's this perfect little bright spot where people come over and get to learn about pollinators and why they're important.
Curator Dominique Fleetus, or Dom as she likes to be called, met me at the zoo's colorful pollinator garden on a sunny afternoon. Along with her work in the Louisiana swamp and jaguar jungle, she helps run the garden and on-grounds apiary program. Before taking me to see the zoo's colonies, Dom wanted to introduce me to some native bees bumbling among the garden's Satsuma trees and Stokesia asters.
So our pollinator garden, we actually got through a grant for Bayer Save the Bee. And so what a pollinator garden is a garden that has plants that are specifically producing extra pollens and nectars and things that our pollinating friends like bugs and bees and butterflies and hummingbirds love to eat, and they need that to survive. And in doing so, they're transferring that pollen from one plant to another to help it fruit. So a lot of our favorite things that we like to eat, like satsumas, are pollinated by bees and things like that. We like to choose plants that have a big pollen source. There's different pollinator plants that have a variety of different attributes. So some being, well, this one might be high in pollen versus nectar. And particularly with bees, they need both to be able to make the hive function and be able to make the honey that we love to eat.
People can come have a look at this and then be inspired to create their own pollinator garden in a very tiny little garden space.
Exactly. And so one of the beautiful things about pollinator gardens is it doesn't have to be huge. Anyone could put even just a small pot in front of their house with the right plants, and it's going to make a difference. You're going to have a couple bees or butterflies visit it, and that's all that they need to do.
Now, Dom, tell me about your native bee here in the garden, because you made me laugh coming over here that there's a native bee that hangs out. Which one is he, and how can you tell?
So everyone is used to the European honeybee. That is the honeybee that beekeepers have that produces the vast majority of honey that we eat. But there's so many different species of native bees that, I mean, I don't even know if we'd be able to count how many. And here in Louisiana, we have quite a few, and I've seen a couple in the pollinator garden. And the one that we're looking at right now on the Indian blanket flower is an all-black bee. And you can see he's got these big yellow pollen baskets from all of the pollen that he's collected from these plants. But I don't for the life of me know what species he is, because every time I try and take a picture of him, he flies away.
Well, it's the most fascinating thing, because if I saw that bee, if you hadn't told me, I would have thought maybe he was just a big black fly.
No, we have a wide variety of native bees, some being black, some being black and yellow, similar to a honeybee or brighter yellow, and some, like our sweat bees, are bright green. Totally different from the bees that you would normally see, but they all have that purpose in pollinating. It's just honeybees do it in such a way that produces so much honey that it kind of is a good human honeybee interaction.
So if someone wanted to start their own garden, are there any particular plants that you would suggest for this climate?
Yeah, so always sticking with your natives is a great thing, because you know the natives are going to grow here. And there's a lot of places that you can get them where you know that they haven't used pesticides, which is very important because that's one of the things hurting our bees. City Park does a garden sale over at the Pelican Greenhouse. The Herb Society locally does a garden sale. But a lot of times things like our native salvias, you could do a small citrus tree like a satsuma. Things that will last a long time, but also keeping in mind that you're going to need to plant things throughout the year. So you don't want something that's just going to be blooming during the springtime, because that doesn't give the bees anything to eat in the fall. So either something that's blooming for a while or that you can change out throughout the year.
Next, Dom and I walked over to a little island in the Louisiana Swamp Exhibit where the zoo's two hives are located. Before we could get close to the colonies, we had to suit up in gear designed to protect us against stings. First, a long, heavy white cotton jumpsuit. Then, a pith helmet and veil made of a breathable mesh material that covered our faces and necks. Finally, heavy leather gloves that crawled up past our elbows. It was 93 degrees that afternoon. And let me tell you, that suit was hot. But as we got closer to the hives containing tens of thousands of bees, I was happy to have some protection.
Okay, Dom, we're all suited up. Here we are. You are the cutest beekeeper I've seen in a long time. Now, what are you doing there?
So I'm lighting our smoker. Oh, there we go. That's what we want to see. A nice, thick, cool smoke.
That looks like a watering can with an accordion on one side.
That's a really good description of it. So a smoker is a beekeeper's best friend. It's one of the few tools you always want to have on you when you're going to enter a hive. And what it is we just have some pine straw in there with a little bit of paper pulp to start a nice cool smoke. And when we open up the hive, we're going to smoke the bees. We're just going to pump that a couple times to release some of the smoke into the hive. And what that does is it distracts the bees from you entering in there. So it's not harming them at all. It's not hot. But it gives them something to focus on that isn't you. Because if someone was to enter your home and start messing around, you'd be upset. But if they came in and maybe gave you some cake, you might be distracted. So this is just something to turn their attention away, kind of blocks their pheromones a little bit from sending out a warning signal, but it's not in any way hurting them. So we'll get it nice and thick. Nice and thick. Oh my. Ooh. So we're going to open up the hive. This is what we call Hive A. It's our hive closer to the White Gator building, and it's our more productive hive. So you can tell it's got an extra box on it because they were already filling up one of their small supers with honey.
A super is a box used to store surplus honey. As Dom opened up Hive A, she blew smoke over the top of the frames to distract the bees as she checked on their progress. Each frame is designed to hold honeycomb, the cells of wax bees make to store their honey or eggs.
So first we're going to check one of these frames. And this is a honey super. So the only thing we should be seeing in here is capped honey if they've finished filling it all up, which is what we've got. And you can see when you hold up to the light, kind of the areas where there might be some darker spots where they probably have brought in some darker pollen, because every flower has a different color pollen. And there's a whole little area on this frame where they've got some dark areas. So this entire box is filled up and looks like this with the capped honey. So it is ready for us to extract it.
How long did it take for them to build this up?
So it all depends on your bees and the time of year and what is blooming. Because this is a hot season and we've got a lot blooming, I think they've had this box now just for a couple weeks. And these bees are fairly productive. But usually within a couple weeks, we'll get a box full. But at some times of the year, and especially if you have a really productive hive, you could have something filled up within a week. The honeybees that we generally think of when we think of, you know, what we're getting our honey from are European honeybees. So they are not native to America, but has become a staple in the, you know, agricultural industry to maintain the amount of crops that we grow here. And across the world, European honeybees have kind of taken over as far as like the main bee for pollinating. And within that, there are different breeds of European honeybee. So a lot of time you'll get Italians or Russians. And even the Africanized bee is just a different breed of honeybee. It's not like a disease that has become on that bee. And each of those breeds has specific traits. So some beekeepers might specifically want to work with one because it is more resistant to parasites or infections. Some are harder workers. Some are a little more aggressive. So they all have these big varieties just amongst the different breeds that they have.
Dom, these bees, some of them, of course, are busy as bees, and they're moving about the frame. Some of them are totally still. Are they resting? What exactly is the behavior?
So we have some bees over here, you can see, eating out of the open comb. So they're eating some of the honey, or they're depositing, depending on what stage they're at. I can see some of these still have pollen in it. So they might be depositing their pollen into those combs to be able to produce honey, while some are eating or cleaning it out. But every bee has its purpose. So you have your bees that are coming back with pollen, you know, on their little pantaloons to be able to place in there. And then some are just making sure that there's food to be able to feed some of the baby bees, which, let's see if we can find a frame where we can find some baby bees. Yeah, the propolis is very sticky and holds everything together.
Also known as bee glue, the propolis is a sap or resinous mixture that bees collect from trees or plants to strengthen the comb and to seal cracks. Breaking through it, we now had the opportunity to see the colony's caste system in action, made up of the queen, workers, and drones.
So what I just did was broke through the propolis that's holding everything together. It's this resin-like material that the bees make. And it also has kind of an antimicrobial property and is used a lot in holistic medicine because you can make teas out of it.
Oh my goodness, that hive is full. They're very engaging.
Aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
So the queen is somewhere in these two boxes. Queens can be difficult to find, but she is working hard and she is laying eggs. So somewhere in the bottom two boxes is usually where you will find her. Most colonies have at least two brood boxes like that for her to lay eggs. But she is a much larger bee than our regular worker bee, so she's a little bit easier to spot. If you can find her taking a quick break.
Searching among the thousands of worker bees, we had no luck locating the queen. This isn't uncommon. In fact, beekeepers will often mark the queen with a dot of paint on her thorax for easy identification.
Oh, you look here. This is a drone bee. So that's a male bee.
He's bigger. He's darker.
He's got big eyes. So most of the bees that you're going to see whenever you're out and about and see them landing on flower, those are going to be your female bees. Those are your worker bees. The drone bee's main purpose in life is to mate, to help keep the population going. But other than that, they don't play too much of a role in the beehive.
What's the life expectancy of bees?
So it changes depending on what type of bee it is. So a queen can live, I think it's up to 7 or so years. I mean, she would be able to run a hive for that long. And as she got older, if she started not managing her workers well enough, her workers might overtake her to get a new queen in the system that's a little younger. But a worker bee only lives for about 23 days. And so they go through the cycle of, you know, as when they're first born, they start with these tasks and then they kind of move up the rank of what they do until they're out bringing in pollen and then helping to keep the hive going by making the sacrifice.
They're all so pretty with their fuzzy little bodies and their shiny, shiny wings. They're just beautiful insects.
They are. Now, they're amazing, especially when you get a chance to look up close at them, just to really take in how gorgeous they are. And you can see a couple of them here just kind of sticking their little tongues in, trying to get a little bit of honey that has spilled. And I get taken away just looking at them because it's an amazing little creatures and as much work as they can get done. And it's, I mean, amazing to think everyone in this hive has a role and they play that role so well. And, you know, they work together to make everything that they do happen. And, you know, if we could do that a little more in our lives.
Isn't that the truth? Dom, thank you so much for taking me into this unknown part of the swamp exhibit where the bees live. Thank you.
No problem. Thank you so much for coming to visit me and the girls.
That was Audubon Zoo curator and beekeeper, Dominique Fleetus.
You see, buzz, buzz, buzz goes the honeybee, but tweedly, tweedly, tweed goes the bird. But the sound of your little voice, darling, that's the sweetest sound I've ever heard. I say, buzz, buzz, buzz goes the honeybee.
Coming up next, we learn about a honey known for its antibacterial properties made by bees from down under. Louisiana Eats returns after the break.
Here we are.
Buzz, buzz, buzz.
That's what the honeybee does.
Tweedly, tweedly, dee.
You know, the bird does that, roughly.
Buzz, buzz, buzz.
Goes the honeybee and...
Tweedly,
tweedly,
dee.
Goes the bird and...
Buzz, buzz, buzz. Goes the
honeybee. New releases shows come thick and fast these days. There is so much great new music, it can feel as if we move on too fast. So we're going to loop back around and listen to some more tracks from recent releases. Join me on the Thistle and Shamrock.
Coming up Sunday at 6 p.m. on KRVS.
Don't you cry. Go to sleep, you little baby.
Until the 1950s, psychologists focused on what was wrong with people. And then came Abraham Maslow.
I don't think there's anything Pollyanna about saying, yes, persons can be improved.
Maslow was really one of the first to think about what's right with the person.
Scaling Maslow's Hierarchy of Human Needs. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
8 o'clock tonight on KRVS.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Camellia Brand, beans done right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923. And from the Napoleon House, located in the historic French Quarter. Dishing up 200 years of history, refreshing Pimm's Cup cocktails, and toasty warm muffuladas. All-day dining and private events at 500 Charter Street. Both mighty and soothing. Honey has long been used for remedial purposes, treating everything from GI tracts to sore throats. While there are hundreds of unique types of honey out there, one has been creating a lot of buzz lately in the world of medicine. Made by bees pollinating a special flower native to New Zealand, Manuka honey is known for its powerful level of antibacterial properties. And with celebrities like Kourtney Kardashian and Gwyneth Paltrow hyping it up, a jar of Manuka honey can cost anywhere from $20 to $120. To get a better understanding of this story, we spoke by phone with David Knoll. He's the founder of Pacific Resources International, which imports and sells Manuka honey products. I asked him to bring us up to speed on the topic.
Yeah, I can give you a kind of encapsulated form. It's kind of a broad subject these days, but typically speaking, Manuka honey was a commercial invalid honey for many, many years because it was a darker honey. It wasn't as sweet as most, and most people just didn't like the looks or the flavor of it, because when you compared it to something like Tupelo that comes out of Florida, or the clover honeys out of Canada, it just didn't have that lighter appearance and the sweeter flavor. And so they used to call it baker's honey and give it away for virtually free in the early days. But we've been importing New Zealand honeys just in general for over 30 years, and the Manuka honey for about 22 years. But a doctor that did digestive disorders out of the Waikato University in New Zealand was looking for natural remedies to help with digestive disorders. And he found that most raw honeys helped with different bacteria and viruses and stuff that could be found in our intestines and our colon and stomach. And at room temperature with the lab, he found that all these honeys worked very, very well. The problem was when he gave these other raw honeys to his patients, nobody got better. In fact, in some cases, they got worse.
Oh.
But he then went on a search for a honey that wasn't affected by your body temperature. What he found was that at room temperature, all these raw honeys worked with no problem. But as soon as you ingest the honey, your body temperature runs at about 98.6 degrees, and that will affect the activity of the honey. And so he went in search of what they call a heat-tolerant honey. And Manuka is just one of them. The Waikato University is in New Zealand, and, of course, the Manuka plant was right in his backyard.
Tell us about the Manuka plant, because I'm sure most of my listeners couldn't visualize that and don't have a clue what it is.
Yeah, most of us would probably just drive right past a Manuka plant. It has no real great outstanding features. It looks like a scrub bush, if you like. It's known as the healing tree in New Zealand because after a mudslide or a fire, something where the vegetation has been devastated, it's the first one to populate the hillsides or the valleys, and it's very aggressive and it's very sturdy. It loves high winds. It loves salt spray. It likes abuse. And so it's the first one to come back in and allow smaller, more delicate trees and plants to grow up under its canopy. And it usually will grow anywhere from about 2 feet to maybe 15 feet. But they're mostly considered originally in New Zealand as a nuisance. They used to clear for making dairy farms or orchards or whatever to get rid of this scrub stuff because it virtually had very little value.
And, of course, it's not the tree making the honey, it's the bees.
That's correct. Yeah, the bees collect pollen and they collect the nectar from these. And funny enough, because the nectar is not as sweet, bees don't particularly prefer the Manuka pollen. And so its only advantage is that the Manuka bush flowers once a year, generally speaking, and it flowers at a time when most other flowers aren't out. So the bees are kind of forced to take the nectar from the Manuka. But just like us, the bees prefer sweeter things. And if there's something sweeter around, they'll go for that and not go to the Manuka.
So how do these beekeepers know that these are bees with Manuka honey?
You never know for sure because you cannot control the bees. They can sometimes have a 50-mile radius around their hive.
I didn't think that they were corralled very easily, so no. I was very curious about all this.
Yeah, well, what they do is because the Manuka is so prolific and it does cover vast areas, they try to take it right into the middle of the Manuka forests and allow it. And again, the advantage is that it usually is flowering at a time when most other things haven't flowered yet. And so the bees have very little choice as to what they want to get it from. In some cases, with the increasing prices, some of the beekeepers have found it advantageous to find remote places. And actually, they'll cut a hole in the bush, and they'll drop the hives in by helicopter. And there's no other way to get to them except by helicopter. And so you have these acres and acres of Manuka that grows wild along the coasts of New Zealand and inland as well. And they'll just cut a hole right in the middle and drop the hives in and then just harvest the honey as the season progresses.
Honey, one of the ways that you test its effectiveness is its peroxide activity. Would you explain about the peroxide activity and non-peroxide activity in Manuka honey?
Certainly. All raw honeys, again, have a peroxide-like activity, and that's why honey has been used since as long as we can find records of man recording stuff, way back to the Egyptians and the Phoenicians. Honey's been used in cosmetics with Cleopatra, has been used as a medicine for all kinds of conditions, either internally or externally. If you got stabbed by a sword or a spear in the early days, the only thing they really had was to pack the wound with honey. You know, if you lived, you lived. If you didn't, you didn't. But honey has a natural antiseptic property that's similar to hydrogen peroxide. It pushes water away from the wound so the bacteria cannot exist, and then it keeps the wound clean so that it can heal. Manuka honey is unique in the fact that it has non-peroxide activity that has the same kill factors as peroxide. And this was a unique finding, and it's really what propelled Manuka to the top of the honey list for healing. Not only does it have maybe 100 times more active components in it than an average raw honey for either diabetic ulcers on the skin or digestive problems like diverticulitis, colitis, irritable bowel syndrome, stomach ulcers, those kind of things, but it also has the ability to build your immune system at the same time with these outstanding properties. Manuka honey is now known as a prebiotic, something that goes in and conditions the stomach so that your friendly bacteria, your probiotics, can proliferate and help you with absorption and digestion and all those kind of things. If you don't have probiotics in your system, if your digestive tract is not running like a high-tuned performance car, you're going to develop some kind of diseases later on in life, like old age diseases like arthritis, diabetes, those kind of things come upon us quickly when our digestive tract is not in tune. And that's what Dr. Peter Mullen found in New Zealand. He was a digestive specialist, and he was the one that first found the Manuka qualities. And that's the key to the success of Manuka and why it's so popular. And it astounds me even today that we sell a jar, one-pound jar of Manuka honey from $20 all the way up to $120. But it's just that it works, number one. And number two, that there's a short demand of it, and that's why the price keeps going up.
Well, I'm a king bee, buzzing around your hive.
That was David Knoll of Pacific Resources International talking to us about New Zealand's Manuka honey.
Well, I can make honey, baby. Let me come inside. Well, buzz a while.
I'm Rick Bayless, and I am the chef and owner of Frontera Grill, Topolo Bampo, Shoko, and Lena Brava in Chicago, and host of Public Television's Mexico, One Plate at a Time.
With his high level of energy and insatiable curiosity, author and educator Rick Bayless is one of America's most lauded celebrity chefs. Throughout his career, he's been a powerful advocate for regional farmers and the environment. As a decline in bee colonies threatens our food system's survival, Rick has focused some of his attention on more apian endeavors. He's helped raise money for the Whole Kids Foundation's Give Bees a Chance campaign, which aims to award 50 schools with honeybee hive grants. And if you eat at one of his restaurants, you could be eating honey made by bees from hives at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport, or maybe even Rick's own backyard.
Rick, it is always a thrill to have a chance to sit down and visit with you. So,
likewise. I love conversations with you because they're very animated and we get into really good topics.
I know that one of the nonprofit efforts that you have been devoting some time and attention to lately has to do with our friends, the pollinators.
Oh, yeah. Well, we have done a couple of fundraisers for the Whole Kids Project. And what their focus is to put beehives in schools. And I know that for a lot of people, they go, oh, that sounds like a disaster waiting to happen because, you know, everybody is afraid of bees. Most people are afraid of bees, but bees are nothing to be afraid of. And actually, we really rely on those pollinators, the bees, to help us get a whole lot of the crops that we are enjoying all the time. I think pretty much everybody has heard that there's a lot of hive collapse going on. Chicago is not the easiest beekeeping climate. Bees can survive our winters just fine. They do the craziest thing. The bees that are in the hive will go to where the queen is, and they will flap their wings really strongly, creating heat, and they will keep that queen alive for the entire winter, even at temperatures below zero in Chicago. What we have had a lot of troubles with lately, oddly enough, is that we have been having very irregular climate stuff, like 60 and 70 degrees in January when we would think it was never even going to break 20, and then getting really cold later in the spring, like below freezing. And the bees don't know what to do with that. And that's caused a massive amount of hive collapse in Chicago because they move. And when they get into those warmer temperatures, they start going out looking for pollen that they can bring back to the hive. And then if it gets really cold again, they don't know what to do with it. And they've already gone into a different mode. So they don't protect the queen. The queen dies. And then there's a hive collapse. About 7 years ago, I started doing some beekeeping. And I will tell you that that is one of the most fascinating things in the world.
Where do you keep your hives?
In my backyard.
Oh, my backyard. Yeah. What a fabulous place.
It is a nice place. It includes a production garden for our restaurants. I wanted to do as much of a complete ecosystem as I could there. And you really do, if you're sort of looking at biodynamics, they insist that you create an ecosystem that has some kind of livestock in it. So my livestock is my bees because they are literally considered livestock for the kind of thing that I'm talking about. I also have chickens. So between the chickens and the bees, I've got my livestock in my garden.
How did you learn the craft of beekeeping?
From a beekeeper. And you can go to classes. There's tons of books that you can read, but it really is one of those crafts that you kind of have to learn directly from someone who knows the ins and outs of it. So we have always had a bee consultant that stops by every once in a while and takes a look at the bees and coaches us through things. The one thing that I was really surprised about with bees is how gentle they are. So you, when you're going to go into the hive to check it, the one thing that you start with is the smoking process. The idea being, and I guess this is, they found that this is really true because it always works, is that when the bees smell smoke, they all return to the hive and they're going to want to protect the queen because they think there's a fire someplace. So it really, they get really super calm. And then you start going down into the hive and pulling up some of the frames and looking at them and making sure that the queen is laying appropriately and they're getting all of their honey in there and they're capping the cells and you're checking it for mites and different things that could possibly go wrong. But the really fascinating thing is how calm those bees are and how those of us that have been doing it for some time, I wear one of those hats, those rimmed hats that has a net that comes down around, basically down to my throat area and in the back. And that's really all I do. And then I just go right in there. And the bees are just so incredibly gentle that if they don't think that you're going to hurt them, they have no reason to attack you. And I think everybody thinks of bees as really mean critters and that they're going to attack anybody that they see and sting them. Well, first of all, bees don't sting, just willy-nilly. They will only do it as a last resort because they die after they sting you. So you have to kind of keep that in mind. But mostly we just kind of go in there, and sometimes they'll crawl around on your hands. But once you get into a sort of symbiotic relationship with your bees, and it really does sort of feel that way when you're going in there, it's just really cool.
I'd love to know what you do with your honey.
Oh.
So you've got the production.
Right.
You've got all the restaurants and places to use the honey. Where does your honey end up?
It ends up in specialty preparations. Certainly, we used a lot of it when we did the fundraisers for the Whole Kids Foundation. And then we use it usually in desserts because people will pay more attention to it in a dessert than they will in a savory preparation where it might not be quite so obvious, its flavor. And so we have two hives, and most of the time we get, depends on what kind of a year it is, but most of the time we'll get someplace between 2 and 3 gallons of honey out of those hives. It's if we were not in the city and our hives are right downtown Chicago, basically, if we were out in a forest preserve or something like that, we could get twice or three times that much honey.
Honeys have different flavor profiles. So what's the flavor profile of the honey that comes from your backyard?
Most people would assume that if it was a downtown honey, that it would probably taste like car exhaust or something like that. But it actually is a very light flower honey. And the one crazy thing about bees is that they can travel for miles away from the hive to collect their pollen. So they're not necessarily collecting just around in our yard. The really young bees usually stay fairly close to the hive, but then they start moving way farther away. And so we have a lot. Chicago's known for its park systems. So there's a lot of places that the bees in our hives can go to collect pollen besides our yard, which has a lot of things blooming in it.
And when you consume your own honey,
yeah,
what's your favorite way to have it? How do you eat your honey?
Well, you know, I will say that there's this one thing that I really love to do. I cook Sunday brunch and Monday dinner at my house every week. And we usually have people over for at least one of those occasions. And because the rest of the time I'm working, and so I'm eating in our restaurants. But on Monday night, I love to make fresh ricotta. So we have this amazing all grass-fed, low-temp, pasteurized, non-homogenized milk that we get from a couple of hours west of Chicago from Kelowna, Iowa. And if you make a fresh cheese out of that, it's just simple acid set. You bring it up at 190 degrees. You add some acid. I usually use lime juice or lemon juice. You let it curdle. You take that, you scoop the curds out, put it into a cheesecloth, give a gentle press to it, and it's ready to serve. So usually I do that right before dinner, and then I put it in the refrigerator to firm up a little bit and to cool down completely, and then drizzle it with honey. And right now we are in the middle of black raspberry season in Chicago. So I mix black raspberries and red raspberries together and put that over this cheese and that honey, and I'll swear it's got to be one of the very best desserts that you could possibly ever eat.
Rick Bayless, chef and owner of Chicago's Frontera Restaurants. Is honey a healthier alternative to sugar? Stay tuned, and we'll explore that topic when we come right back.
KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Get yourself a Titas de Café and drop a quarter into La Lu Jukebox with me, your host, Blake Miller. This jukebox plays all the good stuff. Cajun, country, small pop, Cajun music that sounds like small pop that sounds like country, country that sounds like Cajun, Cajun that sounds...
That's La Lu Jukebox with Blake Miller, Saturday night at 6 and Sunday morning at 7, right here on KRVS.
It's old, oh yeah, but it's still relevant. Things change, but not our love of gold. Music gold, for sure. And the vault is full on the Old Gold Show. Classic and time-tested hits.
There you sit, all by yourself.
Take that nostalgic trip with us on Thursdays at noon on 88.7 KRVS. I'm Lee Kleinpeter.
And I thank you.
Later today on This American Life, a story about doubt and three people who let those doubts spread and gain momentum and convince officials and convince a whole community. And finally, those doubts turn into a kind of fact. We're rerunning this investigation that we did with the Marshall Project and ProPublica that went on to win a Peabody Award and also a Pulitzer Prize, and now is the basis of the new Netflix series Unbelievable. That's later today.
Tonight at 7 on KRVS.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from St. Tammany Parish Tourist Commission. Located 40 minutes from New Orleans French Quarter, the North Shore's Tammany Taste features the chefs and farmers, brewers and bakers of St. Tammany Parish's culinary scene. Visit LouisianaNorthShore.com to discover more. Louisiana's North Shore, where New Orleans has come to play and get away for more than a century. Additional support for Louisiana Eats comes from Cuba Travel New Orleans, a local travel agency now offering an authentic trip to the acclaimed Havana Jazz Festival in 2020, designed to support the Cuban people through music and arts. Visit CubaNewOrleans.com or call 504-252-9774 to book your trip today. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Is honey a healthier alternative to sugar? Sugar ranks higher on the glycemic index than honey, which means it raises blood sugar levels more quickly. This is because of its higher fructose content and the absence of trace minerals. But honey has slightly more calories than sugar, so because it's sweeter, you may be able to use less. Both honey and sugar are carbohydrates, consisting of both fructose and glucose. Sugar's proportions are 50-50,
while honey contains only 40% fructose and 30% glucose. So what's in the rest of honey? Water, pollen, and minerals such as magnesium and potassium, all of which contribute to honey's health benefits. Honey also contains amino acids, antioxidants, enzymes, and vitamins. So what are the health benefits? Honey's been used as a safe cough suppressant since ancient times. Consuming local honey may ease your seasonal allergy complaints, and it's also been proven to help heal wounds and improve some types of dermatitis. God bless the bees. And now, back to more Louisiana Eats.
Queen bee, queen bee, queen bee. Queen bee, please come back to me.
My name is Bridget Breaux, and I am a beekeeper as a hobby, very part-time, and sometimes I'm a stinging cushion for the bees.
My mid-city neighbor, Bridget Breaux, is a real live wire and quite a character. She's a real do-it-yourself girl, and I never know what I'll see that she's up to next. But recently, I was quite surprised to find Bridget out on the street in a bee suit. That's how I discovered the hidden hives of Mid-City. Wait till you hear just where Bridget keeps her hives.
Well, Bridget, I never thought that there would be beekeeping right in this hustling, bustling corridor near Delgado and City Park. Tell me how your interest in beekeeping began.
Well, my father, who is in Picayune right now, when he got up there after Katrina, it's 52 feet or so above sea level, he met a guy that asked him to get into it. So he asked if I was interested, and I'm thinking, it's bees, why not? How complicated is that? So yeah, I said yes. He said, okay, here's a list of what we need to do. So we go get the suit. We get the hive boxes, the frames, the smokers, and whatever else you need to start your beekeeping. And then my dad says, there's a hive that needs to be removed. Do you want to go get it? And I'm like, sure. I should have read the book. We had a friend who does the bee removal, so we went with him. And we brought our box and stuff, and he was using the little vacuum to vacuum the bees into his bucket. As he was cutting the comb, we were putting it in the frames and putting in the box. We finished up there, went back to Picayune, and set everything up like we were instructed to do. And we sat out on the veranda in the Mississippi southern heat and had a refreshing beverage. And then I opened up the book, Beekeeping for Dummies.
And what did you discover in Beekeeping for Dummies?
That as new beekeepers, you should not try to use a hive that you're removing from the wild or catch swarms.
So what happened to that first stab?
Well, they hung around for a while and then they left. So after that, we were going to some beekeeper meetings, and we found out you can buy, they were calling them nukes, and it's like a half of a hive. There's 10 frames in a hive, so you get like 5 frames with your queen. So we go get the bees and we get them in the hive, so we got 2 separate hives, everything's set up and everything looks good. So it seems like that's working, okay? It seems like it's working, and they're like, oh, you need to feed them. And you need to check on them, and you need to make sure the queen's laying eggs, and you need to identify the queen. And I'm in these meetings with my dad, and we're looking at each other going, what? It's bees. How hard is this? How hard is this? So there's a whole list of things you need to do, and you need to check for mites and beetles and moths and all kinds of stuff. And I'm like, had no idea it was this complicated. But we're still going with it. We're going with it. We're smoking the bees. We're getting stung. You know, we got everything on, but somehow we managed to uncover just in time for a sting. So, yeah, they seem to do okay, you know. We'll see.
Well, this is the part that, the other day I see you in the neighborhood. You're obviously, you know, in beekeeping garb. You've got beekeeping accessories with you. And I said, Bridget, where's the hive? Where's the hive, Bridget?
The hive is on the roof.
Now, Bridget, you live in this house right here in the midst of Mid-City. The roof. Okay. How do you get up on the roof?
Well, the second story porch has an access to the roof and the ceiling. So just with a extension ladder, I access the... First, I'm in the attic, and then I'm on the roof. And it is a flat roof with somewhat of a slope. But the yard is, it's wonderful, but to have a hive down here, I think the bees would maybe be a problem with people on the street, with them coming and going. And I didn't want to put anybody at risk with that, because the bees really, like, the only time they get aggressive is when you're messing with their hive.
What to you is the most rewarding part of this beekeeping? Why do you keep at this hobby despite the stings, despite the flyaway bees, despite all of the odds? What keeps you doing this, Bridget?
Well, occasionally harvesting the honey is always a nice bonus, but these little things, I find them real fascinating. How they coordinate things, how they just, you know, make the honey, draw the, you know, make the wax, put the honey in there, draw it all out. And it actually is beautiful to see, you know, all the work that they do, and just to watch them. It's really interesting. Sometimes I'll lay in the hammock in the yard here, and especially when the palmetto blooms, I'll lay there and I'll just watch them. And if you watch them close enough, you can see, the little pollen pockets on their legs and things like that. So, and I don't really understand it, but it's just something super cool to watch them do their thing. And when they look at you with those big eyes, how can you resist?
That was my neighbor, Bridget Bro, keeper of the hidden hives of Mid-City.
When a bee lies sleeping in the palm of your hand, you're bewitched and deep.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Catch up on previous editions and hear all about upcoming special events by visiting poppytooker.com. You can find videos, recipes, and even order cookbooks there. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, Camellia Brand Beans, and St. Tammany Tourist Commission. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef and Louisiana Wagyu in New Orleans French Quarter. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner, and Special Projects Manager, Reggie Morris. And to our Business Manager and Social Media Maven, Maddie Mulladew. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. We're on Instagram and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.